As reporters relentlessly cover the horse race, they're often missing what may be the biggest part of the story, why campaigns do what they do. That often is missed behind a curtain of privately gathered, staggeringly granular data. Two of our producers started digging into this, and they're here now, I guess, to gripe about the lapse in coverage. Chris Neary, welcome to this side of the mic.
Hi there.
PJ Vogt, welcome to you too.
Hey.
So starting with PJ, what's behind this curtain?
So reporters still slice voters into archetypes. You know, middle-aged white males, college students, seniors, soccer moms. But campaigns, more and more, just look at you. We know that for the past 5 to 10 years, they've been doing what they call micro-targeting. That just means that they're setting their sights on actual individual voters. Sasha Eisenberg is the author of Victory Lab, a book about what goes on behind the curtain. He said to us that each of us has a specific entry in these databases.
Which is your name, your address, gender, age, in some cases race, ethnicity. Then there is information from the census about your block or the neighborhood in which you live, which allows a campaign to make projections about your socioeconomic status, your education level, household type.
Then campaigns add more data from commercial firms. So now they know that you subscribe to The New Yorker, that you have a weird obsession with sports, that you went on a vacation with your wife, Michelle.
I'd like to point out to listeners that PJ has stopped describing a hypothetical person and is now describing just me.
I know. I'm sorry. But honestly, for a campaign, you aren't a hypothetical.
They're running algorithms that are basically looking for patterns between that big, massive data they have about each of you with the information that their polling tells them about specific attitudes about the election that's underway.
Here's a case in point. Back in 2002, Mitt Romney was running for governor of Massachusetts. His team was buried in data points, and they were searching for clues about those voters who didn't plan to vote for Romney, but could be convinced.
One of the attributes that unified them was a likelihood of being a premium cable subscriber, basically having HBO.
The campaigns didn't care why premium cable subscribers were more persuadable. They just wanted to find a correlation. But journalists care. So they struggle to find a reason. You know, swing voters seem to have responded to Romney's tough-on-crime policies because it reminded them of The Wire.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, but in 2004, when Bush won re-election, there were a lot of data stories that were nearly that crazy. Here's an example from Eisenberg.
This idea that Karl Rove figured out that Republicans drink bourbon and Coors, and then he went out and found them, and then he got them all to vote a lot more. Almost every part of it is false or exaggerated in ways that totally misrepresent it.
Sure, the Republicans looked at consumer buying habits, but that's just a small part of what's going on behind the curtain. Campaigns are targeting groups of voters that we, as reporters, don't even think of as a group. And if we don't understand the campaign strategy, it's really hard to evaluate if it's working or not.
Okay, so PJ's story is about the magnitude of data. My story is about how it's actually used in the ground game. You know, phone banks and canvassing and, most boring of all, direct mail. Reporters don't report on direct mail unless it's horribly, juicily offensive. But in Michigan, in 2006, a group of researchers randomly selected potential voters from a study group and then sent them one of four different letters. Here's one of those researchers, Columbia's Don Green, explaining how the letters worked.
Each more strongly than the next enforced the norm of civic duty.
The first letter basically reminded you that, yeah, as a society, we've decided voting is good, and please remember that. Then the second letter told you that researchers were actually tracking whether you voted.
Telling people that whether they complied with this norm was going to be monitored as a matter of public record. The point of the study wasn't to make people feel bad. It was basically to test this very basic social psychological proposition about the importance of norms.
Okay, now something from letter three, which was addressed to an entire household and gave the voting history of each member. Here, book, read it.
Okay.
It does sort of make you feel bad.
This chart shows your name from a list of registered voters showing past votes, as well as an empty box, which we will fill in to show whether you vote in the August 8th primary election. We intend to mail you an updated chart when we have that information. Yikes.
All right. And finally, the fourth letter.
Okay. We're sending this mailing to you and your neighbors to publicize who does or who does not vote. The chart shows the names of some of your neighbors, showing which have voted in the past. After the August 8th election, we intend to mail an updated chart. You and your neighbors will all know who voted and who did not. Chris, that sounds like blackmail.
Well, each of the letters boosted turnout, but guess which one worked the best?
The last one, right?
Oh, yeah. 3 times more effective than any other piece of mail ever tested. That's certainly enough to flip a close election. So behavioral psychology is increasingly used as a weapon in campaign wars. And by the way, Brooke, you'll never get that last letter. Campaigns hate to send out anything that prompts virulent hate mail in return, and one of those researchers got some of that mail. But they are running other tests. Let's bring in Hal Malchow here. He says tiny adjustments can dramatically change behavior, like in political fundraising letters, where once a shop accidentally misprinted the stamps on their envelopes and found out that that actually mattered.
They tilted the stamp slightly to the right and got a better response rate on the mailing. I once did a test where every single word of the letter was exactly the same, except that on the carrier envelope and at the top of the letterhead, I put a little campaign graphic, and it says Fowler for Senate, something like that. 30% difference.
Malchow was one of the first political consultants to harness data for direct mail. Those crazy, desperate-sounding emails you get from Obama or Romney asking for money? Malchow says if they're doing it, they've tested it, and it works.
Okay, guys, that actually is fascinating, but what's your gripe?
Campaign reporters need to focus on this stuff. This is the real battlefield.
And look, we know the reporters don't have access to those databases or the results of the tests the campaigns are running.
But Eisenberg says that's no reason to give up reporting on campaign data.
I think that there's a sort of useful analogy to military coverage. People who cover the Pentagon realize they don't understand how drones work. They don't understand how drone targeting is done. And yet, military correspondents have figured out how to write that ambiguity and uncertainty and unknowability as part of the story and not confuse our readers into thinking that we know everything about what they're doing with drones.
So look, we don't want reporters to break into the data centers. We just want them to be honest about what they don't know.
And to adjust their narratives to the age of algorithms. I mean, Brooke, is that so much to ask?
Yeah, probably. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, VJ.
Thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.